Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, the H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the famous 57 varieties, gives you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York City. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. If we use your question, the H.J. Heinz Company will send you $10 in war stamps, plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpohl. And now, our master of ceremonies, book reviewer of the New Yorker magazine, Clifton Fadiman.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and unrehearsed as ever, Information, Please, offers tonight its three regulars, John Kiernan of the New York Sun, Oscar Levant, and Franklin P. Adams. And as its guest, the gallant soldier and Pulitzer Prize winner, Colonel Carlos P. Romulo, author of the bestseller, I Saw the Fall of the Philippines. And before we start, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to correct an error of last week for which I am entirely to blame. A question came from Aaron Baxt of New York, and Mr. Baxt asked us to identify the term Lewisite, L-E-W-I-S-I-T-E. Mr. Sinclair Lewis, who was one of our guests, and for whom Lewisite, by the way, was not named, one of its claims to fame, said that it was an explosive. Mr. Lewis was so confident that I accepted what he said as gospel truth. Several thousand people told us, however, that it was not an explosive, but a poison gas that might be used in chemical warfare. That was one part of a three-part question, and inasmuch as another part was also answered incorrectly, Mr. Baxt is entitled to a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica and 57 in war bonds and stamps. I think that settles that. Is that right, Mr. Adams?
That's right. He deserves it.
Okay. And now our first question. It comes from Winifred Lorenzen of Chicago. Who sent and who received these messages? These are famous messages. Tell us who sent them and who received them. There are going to be three of them. Let's get two out of three. The first is, I came through and I shall return. Colonel Romulo.
General MacArthur.
Yes. When did he say that?
In Australia, when he arrived from Bataan.
Yes, and he was referring to?
To his having gone through the blockade, Japanese blockade, and his having gone through and arriving in Australia and returning to the Philippines.
Yes. I gather, Colonel, that you think that one part of that statement is just as true as the other.
Both are correct.
Yes, quite right. And how about this one? Thou sleepest, awake and see thyself. Speak, strike, redress. Thou sleepest, awake. A message sent to whom and received by whom?
John L. Lewis.
I think not, Mr. LeBan. Mr. Kieran, you've got that reflective look.
Is that from Shakespeare?
It is indeed.
It's a note, I believe, that was thrown into Brutus's porch.
That's right. Mm. Good stuff, Mr. Kieran. That's not by any means one of the easier things to remember from Shakespeare. Who sent the message to Brutus?
Well, lean and hungry Cassius was suspected.
100%, John. How about this one? Orders you gave me on August 15th, 1942 have been fulfilled. I now await your further instructions. Message sent by whom? To whom? This is fairly recent. Mr. Levant.
Admiral Halsey. No, it's before Halsey.
No.
That was the original Guadalcanal.
No.
I was so confident.
It's the other side of the world, Mr. Levant.
General Eisenhower.
No, but in that general direction. It was a letter to Winston Churchill from General Sir Harold Alexander.
That's right.
Marking his triumph over the Axis in Egypt, Cyrenaica, and that part of the world. Well, that gives us two out of three. Off the record, who sent and who received this message? A very simple one. A very memorable one, simply, remember freedom. Colonel Romulo, remember? I'm going to ask you to answer that. Remember freedom?
I said that.
You said, yes. It did come back to you, did it not? And whom was the message from? And whom was it addressed to, Colonel?
That was a message sent by the members of the staff of General MacArthur through me.
Yeah.
To say to the people of America here, remember freedom.
We shan't forget it.
And now the second question. This comes from Dwight C. Lyman of New London, Connecticut. How do these fictional characters, gentlemen, earn their living? The first is John Oakhurst. John Oakhurst, Mr. Adams.
He was a gambler.
He was a gambler, yes. Where do you find him, Mr. Adams?
In The Luck of Roaring Camp and other Bret Hart stories.
I guess he's in The Outcast of Poker
he's
Flat.
He's in that. And,
Bret Hart.
That's right.
Bret Hart story.
Outcast of Poker Flat.
Quite right, Mr. Adams. Now, how about this?
He dies.
He dies. Right. That finishes that up. How about the Duke and the Dolphin made their livings by doing, Mr. Curran, what?
They were not common swindlers. They were uncommon swindlers. They're the two raffish characters on a raft in Mark Twain's...
Raftish.
That's right. Huckleberry Finn.
Huckleberry Finn, yes. They. What do they do?
Swindle the yokels.
Yes. Sold patent medicine. That's
medicine biz.
Yes,
well, they
medicine
did everything.
Biz. How about Jerry Cruncher? How do you make a living, Mr. Curran?
Well, ostensibly, he had two businesses. He was a porter for a bank, but he was really a grave robber on the sly. There was more money in that.
Yes, that's right. He
used to turn over cadavers to medical students.
Yes. What was the term that they used for that sort of business?
He said that he used to go fishing, and he began to fish at midnight with a spade.
Yes, that's right. But he had another term for
body himself. Body snatching.
No, the resurrection man.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Resurrection man. You find all this, Mr. Curran, in what book?
The Tale of Two Cities by C. Dickens.
Good enough. That gives us 3 out of 3. How about this one? Get the idea of this, Colonel? You see, this is very simple. How about this from Mary R. Campbell of Bronxville, New York? I'm going to name 3 ships. Each of them did a certain job. Tell me what each did. Get 2 out of 3. The SS Legaspi, L-E-G-A-S-P-I, the SS Legaspi.
The SS Legaspi.
Colonel Romulo.
Ran through the Japanese blockade and brought rice to the soldiers in Bataan.
Yes. How many times did it do that, Colonel?
Twice.
And what happened to her?
The third time she was sunk.
She was sunk. We haven't heard from her. That was quite right. What does the name Legaspi come from, Colonel?
From one of the Spanish conquistadores who went to the Philippines after Magellan.
Good enough, yes. That was in the latter part of the 16th century, then,
yes.
It must have been. How about this ship? The Gripsholm did what? I have several hands. Mr. Levant.
That was the Swedish ship which exchanged envoys between Japan and America.
Yes, and what did it bring back as a...
Brought back Ambassador Grove from Tokyo.
Well, it brought back a number of Americans who were caught in Japan.
And correspondence.
Correspondence, quite right, Mr. Levant. How about the USS Merritt? M-E-R-R-I-T-T, Colonel Romulo again.
The USS Merritt was the transport that was sent by General MacArthur from Manila to bring relief to the Japanese after that disastrous Yokohama earthquake.
Yes. And what happened?
And then when the forces of General MacArthur bombed Subic Bay, that was when the Japanese were trying to land troops there.
Yes.
We found out that they had... used the life preservers of the USS Merritt in those boats, in those transports that they had in Subic Bay.
Yeah, I think we were suckers, Colonel Romulo, after the earthquake. Begins to look that way, doesn't it? Well, that gives us 3 ships out of 3. How about this one from Francis D. Fisher of Piedmont, California? This is about guests of literature, all of whom were uninvited. I'll tell you a little about them. Tell me who they are. The first uninvited guest... ate the lady of the house, devoured the lady of the house. Mr. Curran.
The wolf who had such big teeth with which he ate up grandmother.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's right. A good way of getting along without a ration card. And what uninvited guest broke the furniture? Broke the furniture. This again comes from legend and fairy tales. Mr. Adams, can you reach back into your childhood?
Oh. Blew the house down. He huffed and he puffed.
You got the wrong fairy tale.
Well, if you blow a house down, you live in it.
There was a house blown down in the story of the 3 Little Pigs. I don't know that any furniture was broken. Remember when Goldilocks visited the house of the 3 Bears? She sat down in the littlest chair and broke it. That's one wrong. Now, what uninvited guest made the big catch of the evening? Made the big catch of the evening. Mr. Adams.
Cinderella.
Cinderella, yes. Whom did she get?
The prince.
Yes, we never have... We've never heard what happened after that. That gives us 2 out of 3. So far, no stumps. How about this from Bryce Hayes of Chicago? Gentlemen, this is a musical question. You're going to hear 3 compositions played, parts of them. Each of them should suggest a war to you, a certain war. Tell me who fought in this war and who won the war. Let's have the first. It'll be a tough thing if we missed on this one, Mr. Adams.
That is supposed to be the American Revolution.
Yes, it was the American Revolution.
And was won by the American colonies.
Good enough, yes. Now, the second is a little harder, but not very much harder. That recalls, Mr. Levant, what war?
Keep the Home Fires Burning, an English song by Ivan Novello. Refers to the First World War.
Yes, and...
We won it temporarily.
We won it temporarily, if you want to call it a victory. That's quite right. Was that Ivor Novello, did you say, that wrote that song?
I may be wrong. He wrote 1 of 2. Either that or Tipperary.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember. How about this one? This is the third and last war. Go ahead. Mr. Kieran?
That was the sad song of the Spanish-American War. Just break the news to Mother.
That's right. And the winner, Mr. Kieran?
Well, the winner was the United States of America.
Quite right. Now, how about this one? Well, I guess that's all we have time for the moment. Here's our 57 Varieties reporter, Ben Grauer, with some good down-to-earth advice for victory gardeners.
Since we're all raising gardens for food and not strictly for fun this year, we'd do well to heed the advice of the experts. They tell us to raise vegetables that will give us the most food value for the space they require. Highly nourishing things such as tomatoes, carrots, kale, turnips, or spinach, for instance. They urge us to plan our garden so that by means of successive sowings and plantings, we'll have fresh vegetables from early spring until winter. And above all, we'll have grown enough surplus so we'll have plenty of vegetables for canning and storing. H.J. Heinz, like every other American food manufacturer, is busy with the tremendous job of feeding our armies and allies. So we Americans will have to do without a lot of the labor-saving, fully prepared foods we're used to. So let's all make a big effort to raise as much of our food as we can in our victory gardens. Let's make the hoe and spade and trowel pinch hit for the can opener.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. And now we'll go on with a question from Ralph Boswell of New York. According to the derivation of these words, what would be the nationality of a person if we said of him that he runs amok? What nationality? Colonel Romulo.
He must be a Moro.
A Moro. And what is a Moro?
Mohammedan Filipino.
Yes. Is that what language does that come from, the
That's
word amok?
Malay.
Malay. And what does it mean exactly?
To run wild.
To run wild. In your experience, Colonel Romulo, did you ever see any Moros?
Unfortunately,
run amok?
No.
You have not. Mr. Kieran?
I think we got it through the English. I don't think we imported it ourselves.
That's right. I think it did come.
It was a book by Stefan Zweig, in which I thought it was a Dutch East Indian colony.
Well, I guess the term is used throughout...
A-M-O-K.
A-M-O-K or A-M-U-C-K. It's used throughout that section of the world, Mr. Levant.
It almost is spelled like LaGuardia's spelling of coffee.
How about this? Now, if a person went berserk, what nationality would he be? You have to know the derivation of the word berserk.
Brooklyn Dodger.
Mr. Levant, that's not a nationality. It's a state of mind. Mr. Kieran?
I don't really know. Frank, do you know you can...
I don't know. It sounds a little Dutch.
Far removed from it, Mr. Kieran.
I was going to say Scandinavian.
That would be right. I wish you'd said it just a second before...
Well, I wasn't confident.
Scandinavian, yes. The berserkers were, in antique Scandinavian times, a class of wild warriors who became frenzied in battle. They ran amok, too, but they called them berserk. Colonel Romulo, I hate to ask this question, but I'm interested in knowing how the Japs act when they're in battle. Are they very calm and collected?
No, they are fanatics, of course, and they act as if they were in a sort of a trance.
They do.
Yes, when they fight.
Very different from the way in which we're accustomed to fighting.
They really fight like automatons.
Yeah. That may be the secret of their final defeat, don't you think, Colonel Romulo?
That is going to be the reason for their final defeat.
You bet. And now, if we said of a person that he went haywire, What nationality? Mr. Levant.
Brooklyn.
Yes. No, that ain't haywire.
Or more generally, American.
American, yeah.
Mr. Adams, what does the term come from, to go haywire? How do we get that term?
Wire getting in the hay.
I don't remember.
Well,
that's right. It is
something like that.
I'll give a guess. Wire going in the hay, but wire coming off the hay. If you've ever cut the wire off a bundle of hay, you've got to watch yourself.
That's right. It's very stiff. And when it comes off, it's apt to get all snarled up and tangled.
Comes off like a whip.
Yeah, have to be very careful of it. That gives us 3 out of 3. How about this one from Martha B. Williams? Gentlemen, it would be a very good thing for Mr. Morgenthau if you could manage to get a couple of these answers wrong tonight. Martha B. Williams of Columbus, Ohio. Give 3 song titles that mention children's toys. Or to get 4 or 5, I'll ask for only 3, Mr. Adams.
The little toy dog is covered with dust.
That's a very pretty and affecting one, Mr. Kieran.
I didn't...
I beg pardon, Mr. Levant.
Drums in my heart.
Drums in my heart, sure. It's the drums that is the toy, of course.
In the old days, it was.
That gives us 2. Can you think of another, Mr. Adams?
Well, there's one, that Playmate song about my... something about my dolly. I forget what it is.
I forget it entirely.
Yes, there is. My dolly has the flu.
Is that the title of the song?
No, that isn't the title, but that's in the song.
it's got to be the title?
Got to
give me the title.
Title of a song?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Animal Crackers in My Soup.
That isn't a song, is it?
Shirley Temple sang it, and I wish you and I had what she made out of it.
Really? All right. There are a number of others you could think of. After the Ball, Mr. Adams, that would be a child's toy. Or Mr. Levant, Parade of the Wooden Soldiers, might be another one. There are 3 or 4 or 5. How about this for Mrs. J.M. Johnson of Lakewood, Ohio?
Goodbye, Dolly Gray.
A little late, but very good, Mr. Adams. What places are often referred to in the news by these phrases? The first is the soft belly of the Axis. Mr. Levant.
That's the southern part of Italy, the Adriatic Sea, Yugoslavia, Greece, Crete, so forth.
Yes, sir. Presumably one of those places is going to be the direction of the big push.
You want me to make a prophecy?
Yes, why not?
Greece,
all right. He picks Greece. How about this? What place is often referred to in the news as an unsinkable aircraft carrier? An unsinkable aircraft carrier. Mr. Kieran?
Well, an island is an unsinkable aircraft carrier.
But which one particularly would you say?
Well, Honolulu on a large, but Midway.
Some of the
Alaskan bases.
Well, you might put up a case, but I think there's one particular island, Mr.
Oh, well, you mean Malta?
Malta was the one I was thinking of, yes. And as a matter of fact, before the war is over, I shouldn't be surprised if England itself would be a big unsinkable aircraft carrier. How about this? A dagger pointed at the heart of Japan refers to what? Have 1, 2, Mr. Kieran?
That would be Vladivostok.
Vladivostok,
the peninsula,
yes,
there.
That's right. Why?
Do they call that Vladivostok?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
You don't know me, Kieran.
How about that, Colonel?
I think so.
It's all I can do to know the initial letter of it.
Same pronunciation as Shostakovich. Vladivostok.
Vladivostokovich?
No.
Vladivostok is right. And why, Mr. Kieran, do they use the phrase?
Well, because it goes right down there toward Japan.
Yeah, it doesn't really stick out very much. But
no,
it's,
but it just points right at it.
Yes, and there is
the nearest base. My mouth waters. Let's not talk about it anymore.
It's a good idea. I know just what you're thinking of. How about this from Hugh D. Beach of New York City? I want you to recite for us a line of poetry or prose that includes these words, the word naughty, then the word horrid, then the word evil. Let's begin with the nicest of the words, naughty. How about a line of poetry that has the word naughty in it? Mr. Adams.
It's naughty, but it's nice.
Yeah,
that's a good one, yes. What's that from, Mr. Adams? I never knew.
I think that's a song.
Mr. Levant, do you know it?
That's in the Victor Herbert era. I don't remember who wrote it. Is that K-N-O-T-T-Y?
No.
You're thinking of Naughty Marietta.
You're thinking of a naughty hole, like a knot hole. How about Mr. Kieran? Did you have
about naughty?
No, about horrid.
Oh, yes.
Horrid.
There was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of a forehead.
That's the one, yes. And how about the word evil? Well, I should be able to get a number of Mr. Adams.
The evil that men do lives after them.
Yes, a very good one. And love of money is the root of all evil. Mr. Adams. That gives us 3 out of 3. How about this? Or shall we hold up on that for a moment? Here's our Heinz reporter, Ben Grau, with another report from the makers of the 57 varieties.
For years, we at Heinz have been telling you folks how we prepare your foods with genuine old-fashioned care. How particular we are about keeping our modern kitchen spotless. How we insist on using the finest scientific methods. Well, there's another very practical side to us, too. You see, we feel that all that care and skill isn't enough. We want to be sure that the 57 varieties always have the kind of flavor that makes a hit with everybody. So each week, we select a different committee of men and women of all ages from every department of H.J. Heinz Company. They sit around a long table and sample old products as well as new ones, judging them for taste, aroma, appearance, color, and texture. These people form our all the 57... That's a pretty good way, we've found, to see that our foods please the biggest flavor jury of all. You who have passed your very favorable judgment on Heinz 57 varieties at your own dinner tables these many years.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. A question from Dickie Blodgett of St. James, Long Island. What was the rank of each of these American naval heroes at the time that they gained their greatest success? The first is George Dewey. What was his rank when he gained his greatest success? Sir Colonel Romulo.
Rear Admiral.
No, he, Mr. Kieran?
I think it's a rank that is not now used in the Navy. Commodore.
Commodore. Commodore is right, yes. Is that rank now abolished in the Navy?
Well, I don't hear it anymore.
I don't hear it
either. Sort of throws a balance out. You can't keep track of the Naval and Army ranks anymore.
It's abolished. There's a gap.
I guess it is.
The hotel took it over.
Well, that gives us one wrong. Mr. Colonel Romulo came in a little too quickly on that one. How about this? John Duncan Bulkley. When he gained his greatest success, what was his rank, Mr. Levant?
Lieutenant something, hyphen, lieutenant. Come on, John.
Lieutenant.
He was a lieutenant.
Captain. Lieutenant.
Lieutenant, yeah.
Lieutenant.
You meant lieutenant all along, didn't you?
Well, I didn't believe I could lieutenant. Be right.
Yes. Lieutenant Bulkley, at that time, is now a lieutenant commander. Did you ever meet Lieutenant Bulkley,
yes,
Colonel Romulo?
Yes, I met him.
Under favorable circumstances?
Yes, and we were together in Australia.
Oh, yes.
Before he left.
But we think very highly of him in this country.
Very highly. We think of him, too, there.
Good. Very good. How about this? From Daniel J. This is Daniel J. Callahan. What was his rank? Now, Mr. Levan.
Rear Admiral.
Rear Admiral, yes. Is absolutely right. And who was...
On the San Francisco.
On the San Francisco,
he
yes.
Was a great hero.
A great hero, yes. Yes. Who was the captain of the flagship under Rear Admiral Callahan at that time?
Young man, you mean?
Captain Cassin Young. Captain Cassin Young was the captain. that gives us 2 out of 3.
He was the commander of the ship.
Yes, that's right. Mrs. Florence C. Schwartz of New York sends this one in. I'm going to give you the names of 3 people. What do they like to do in their spare time? The first is C. Auguste Dupin.
What?
I knew that would get you. Mr. Kieran understands my Chinese. Mr. Kieran.
Yes. He was a friend of, the creation of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah. What did he like to do?
Why, he liked to unravel mysteries. Yes. He was a detective.
Yes.
On his own.
That's right. In what famous stories would you
find
him appearing?
The Purloined Letter, for one, and the other was Murders in the Rue Morgue.
Yes, there's a third.
Vincent Pomeroy.
Will. The Mystery of Marie Roget.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Those are the 3.
Oh, well, wait a minute. Was he in that?
I believe he was.
Read it through, John.
I did read it through.
We have no time. Rip Van Winkle, in his spare time, liked to do what? Rip Van Winkle, Mr. Adams.
He was a bowler.
Well, he watched some bowling.
In
but...
his spare time, slept.
Well, he had a hobby, Mr. Kieran.
Why, he went hunting. He went fowling, as a matter of fact,
yes.
With his dog and
his dog
fowling
Snyder's.
Piece.
Yes, that's right. Hunting and also drinking.
He was going to
small way.
That.
Yes.
In a big way.
Penelope liked to do what in her spare time? Mr. Adams, try
I
you
think
again.
She was a spinner.
Yes. What did she like to do after when evening drew on and everybody went to bed?
She became expendable.
I don't know, this is on the air.
Mr.
She unspun it again.
Yeah, she unraveled the piece of weaving that she used to weave during the day. That gives us about 2 1/4 out of 3. Sends us on to one from Mrs. Edward Payson Drew of Newton, Massachusetts. Name the man who became president of each of these nations. Now, the first nation was one that changed from the territory of a republic into a self-governing commonwealth. Who was the president of Mr. Adams?
That would be Texas.
Territory of a republic into a self-governing commonwealth. Now, Texas never became a self-governing commonwealth.
Is that Czechoslovakia?
Colonel Romulo.
Manuel El Quezon.
Yes, Manuel Quezon. And we're referring to what nation?
Philippines.
The Philippine Islands, yes. Texas never became a self-governing commonwealth, unless you've been rewriting history in your spare time.
I call a state a commonwealth. It's Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Yes, you want to say that again? You know you're not right, Adams. Just putting up a last-ditch fight, that's all. One wrong on that. Now, what man became president of a nation that changed from an absolutist empire directly into a republic? Without any intervening steps, Mr.
Germany.
Obama? Pardon?
Germany. Ebert became president. They were an empire before. Pardon?
Well, no, that wouldn't be exactly right because...
Why wouldn't
theoretically, Kaiser Wilhelm was the head of a constitutional monarchy.
Well, then you mean France.
Really? No.
No.
Well,
Paderewski?
Pardon?
Poland, was it?
Paderewski? No.
No.
No. Do the question again.
All right. You do better do the answer again. One that changed from an absolutist empire directly into a republic. I think there's only one possible answer, Mr. Kieran.
Russia.
No. There were several intervening steps there.
I didn't notice them.
Well, they went very quickly from 1917 to 23. No, the answer is Sun Yat-sen, who became president of China in 1911. Colonel Romulo, would that not be right?
That's correct.
It was an
absolutely.
Absolute monarchy before that.
I think Germany's correct, my answer.
Sun Yat-sen.
Possibly, if it is.
Well, they don't care about it anymore. Why should I?
Buy a cup of coffee if you're right, Mr. Band. How about this one? The man who became president of a nation that changed from being 5 provinces of a dual monarchy into a republic.
That's Czecho.
That's Czecho, and who was the man?
Benesh.
No.
Masaryk.
Masaryk. Czechoslovakia used to be made up of 5 provinces of Austria and Hungary. I think we lose $57 in war bonds and stamps and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica, which go to Mrs. Drew, courtesy of the H.J. Hines Company. And that sends us on to this question from Gloria Carlton of Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Now, this, again, is a musical question, gentlemen, and it is all about spring, a season in much in demand at the moment. Give the correct titles to these songs about spring. Let's have the first. Mr. Levant.
By Christian Sinding, and it starts on B-flat with a thumb. What's the name of it?
What is the name of it?
It's something about spring.
It is. And what's the name of it?
Spring's Awakening.
No.
Now, if I... it has something to do with Krauss. You know Krauss? What's Krauss's first name?
Russell. Russell of Spring.
Russell of Spring, yes. It's hard helping, Levant. That's quite right. Now the second one. Mr. Levant again.
Spring is here, yada-dee. Spring is here, by Rodgers and Hart.
Rodgers and Hart. That's 2 right. And the third and last. Mr. Levant again.
Floods of Spring, by Rachmaninoff.
Yes.
The late Rachmaninoff.
Pardon me?
The late.
The late Rachmaninoff, we regret to say. Well, that's 3 springs out of 3. That gives you the musical title...
Spring.
Spring. Quite right. The H.J. Hines Company tonight, therefore, has paid out only $57 in war bonds and stamps, and that means 1 set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Colonel Romulo, we're very glad that you came down. Not only to answer the question so well as you did, but to allow us the chance to welcome a defender of liberty.
Thank you.
Next week, John Kieran and Franklin P. Adams will battle with 2 charming ladies, Jan Struther of Mrs. Miniver fame, and the celebrated actress and co-author of Our Hearts Were Young and Gay, Cornelia Otis Skinner. Remember to send your questions and the correct answers to information, please, at